some of these charges, that to an outside observer, to a regular reporter who's been following this process for, you know, about 2 years now, that it looks like there's no evidence for any of these charges, and yet one can also see the judge hedging and deciding that she's going to split the difference and give Manning some kind of a sentence where he wouldn't get out of jail until he was 50 or 60 years old.
Then what you were most surprised by in the prosecution's case against Bradley Manning?
Well, what's been so surprising is that they don't have a lot of evidence. They have mostly circumstantial evidence. They can prove what Manning confessed to, that he willfully communicated this information to persons that were unauthorized to receive it, which, in a sense, is a violation of the Espionage Act, although I will say that there are other ways to prosecute and go after individuals who violate this act. You don't have to treat them as spies, as our government is doing, and how the Obama administration has gone after a record number of individuals. But there's all of these different instances of passing on information, and they want to say he exceeded authorized access on his computer when he didn't do any hacking. They want to say that he stole the information when he had regular access to the material, and it was fully within his privileges as a intelligence analyst to have the information on his computer. And so that is why, as we're seeing in this court martial right now, the defense is pushing to get dismissed or to get a finding of not guilty on about half of the charges.
Kevin Gostala, civil liberties blogger at Fire Dog Lake. He's been covering Bradley Manning's trial at Fort Meade, Maryland, every day since it's begun. Kevin is the co-author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. The judge hearing the case against Private Bradley Manning at Fort Meade said she would decide Thursday on Manning's lawyer's request to dismiss seven of the charges, including allegations that he aided the enemy when he provided hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. You can go to democracynow.org to visit all our past coverage on Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks. Also go there to see our extended interviews with Glenn Greenwald, with Michael Ratner, the attorney for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and others. That's democracynow.org. You can also visit our Facebook page and tweet about us. Let your friends know about this independent, daily, unembedded, investigative international news hour. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, Christian Goff, Vesta Gadars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Rockham Penny, Carlo De Jesus. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org.
This is Donna with your WUSB concert billboard for Sunday, July 14th. The Fast Lane and Copper Line will be at Theater 3 in Port Jefferson, 7 p.m. Karen Clark Sheard will be at the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead, 7 p.m. Sarah Cahill, Gray McMurray, and Doug Bellier will be at Spectrum, all beginning at 2 p.m. Small Black will be at the Surf Lodge in Montauk, 7 p.m. Steel Brunch with the Jimmy Kenny Pirate Band will be at the Dublin Deck, 11:30. Marley Fest, the RBC, Soul Junkies, Root Revelators, Nonstop to Cairo, and more will be at the Vanderbilt Museum in Centerport, beginning at noon. The Almost, the Rocket Boys, will be at Revolution in Amityville. On your billboard for Monday, July 15th, the Monkees will be at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester. Who Are Those Guys will be at Mitchell Park in Greenport, 7:30. Your billboard for Tuesday, July 16th, NRBQ will be at B.B. King's Manhattan. Miss Tess and the Bon Ton Parade will be at the Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 2. East Coast Collective will be at the Even Flow Bar and Grill in Bayshore. Dublin Deck presents Next Level at 6. Jazz in July Festival, Fats Waller, Handful of Keys, with Bill Charlap and Carol Woods at the 92nd Street Y, New York City. Looking ahead to Wednesday the 17th, Billy Ocean will be at Tanner Park in Copeg.
If you hear some musician on WUSB, you'll hear where they're playing locally on Concert Billboard. arenas, bars, coffee houses, or outdoor festivals. They're all here at WUSB.FM/CBB and 90.1 FM WUSB Stony Brook, New York.
And this is WUSB Stony Brook, 2 minutes after 6 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Wall. Thank you. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday afternoon / evening. We're in the middle of a heat wave, which fortunately is not extending into the studio, and that's always a relief, but I don't know, it's not bothering me this time. Even when I'm outside, I'm kind of chill. I'm just kind of, you know, not really feeling miserable, despite the fact that it's hot and humid, because I know it's going to be over. It's all going to be over. At some point, the sun will burn out, and this kind of misery will end. But no, the heat wave will be ending, they say, over the weekend. So that means the whole week will be like this. That's fine. No problem. I'm too caught up in other things to even notice. Unless things physically start to burn around me, I'll probably just go through the entire week and pay no notice to the whole thing, which suits me just fine. A couple of programming notes. We have an interesting summer planned. Well, by we, I mean the people behind the program. I don't know about the entire station. I don't know about the rest of the world. I guess it's up to all of us to make our summers and our days and our lives interesting. But that's neither here nor there. This year, Kyle and I will be heading over to the Ulm conference. And by the way, it's still not too late to get tickets or to head over to the Netherlands from July 31st through August the 4th and meet some really cool people. I don't mean us. Yeah, we qualify, I think. But there are so many, thousands of other people there from all around the world who will be building a village in the middle of a farm field somewhere in the Netherlands and having better connectivity than you can get here in Long Island and electricity and all the comforts that you think you need. They'll be around in one form or another. More details, Ulm 2013, ohm2013.org. But obviously in the month or so that we'll be away, yeah, we're going to be away for a month, pretty much the end of July and most of August. And you can bet there'll be some really good audio recorded wherever it is we wind up going. But in that period of time, there'll be recorded programs here from previous sojourns to various places that we have not yet aired. So we're taking care of you. Don't worry about that. And next week, Kyle will be here back in the studio as we prepare to journey onwards. Also want to thank people who have filled out the WUSB survey. Maybe you don't know about it because we haven't talked about it before, but it's been mentioned on various programs and in various places. And I want to thank the people who have already filled it out and mentioned Off the Wall or Kyle and myself as their favorite hosts. It's kind of cool to see that sometimes. But you can fill out the survey too if you listen to WUSB, which if you hear me saying that, yes, you qualify. You do listen. And all you have to do is go to the website, wusb.fm. Okay, it's not that quite that simple. I wish it was. But you have to scroll down a little bit. I think it's the fourth story down. It says, please help improve WUSB Stony Brook's radio station by taking our survey and you can get a free WUSB sticker! That's the headline. The USB sticker, it's worth taking the time to answer some questions. And just to give you a preview, some of the questions. And don't panic when it takes you to Google, because that's where it's a Google Doc. You don't need to have an account to read it or anything like that. And I don't think the NSA really cares about this, but who knows. Some of the questions we'll be asking include, well, if you listen to the radio, for one thing, it's kind of good to know that. When you listen, what kinds of things you listen for, various things. I don't want to give it all away. Some of it is geared towards local audiences, but it can be filled out by anybody throughout the entire planet. But I'm not sure how much longer it's going to be up, so definitely go to WUSB.fm and fill that out if you are so inclined. And we're not saying that you have to indicate this is your favorite program. You can say this is the worst program. Any kind of feedback. We're just asking for feedback. We like to know what people think. But please, keep it clean. Well, you don't have to, but children read it, so yeah. What a week, hey? It's something. You know, even my jaded self was surprised by some of the things that I've seen. I thought I've seen it all. Well, I thought I'd seen most of it anyway. A good part of it, or a bad part of it, really. But over the last couple of weeks, what I saw, not that I was watching, other than being updated on it, because I didn't really have a choice, but I saw a guy being put on trial for his own murder. It was incredible. It was simply staggering to watch what many referred to, either out of ignorance or out of cynicism, as the Trayvon Martin trial. People would say that, and they weren't aware that, you know, that's the guy that died. He's not really on trial. It's George Zimmerman that's on trial. The guy who killed him. Yeah. Well, you know, some people got that. Some people said that intentionally because he was put on trial. But some people really didn't realize that. I don't want to theorize as to why. Is it the black guy that's always on trial even when he's dead? Is it just because you're not paying any attention whatsoever and that's the name you keep hearing more often? Who knows? Not really interested. But following this case was really eye-opening. Yeah, it was the Trayvon Martin trial. I saw people testifying to the fact that this guy smoked marijuana. That a 17-year-old kid smoked pot. And that was something that was used against him. That was something that actually was part of the justification for him being shot dead. Now, they didn't say it in so many words, but why else would you bring something like that up, if not to tear down his character just a little bit at a time? And there were so many other ways that they did this. Forgetting the main point, which is what actually happened and why it should never have happened. And seeing, I knew the verdict was going to come out this way. I think I even mentioned that on the radio. It was pretty obvious from the way they were setting Trayvon Martin, who could not defend himself. They're setting him up to be some kind of hoodlum, pointing to every indiscretion of his past. And you show me a 17-year-old that does not have indiscretions in his past or even in his present. He was pretty much a normal kid. And normal kids do get in trouble. It does happen. It's not a death sentence. More time was spent focusing on his indiscretions than on George Zimmerman, the guy who pulled the trigger. But when that verdict was announced, I think what I was more repelled by was the way it was talked about, both by the people who were the prosecutors and by the defense. First of all, the prosecution, I don't know if you saw this press conference, they look like they just won the lottery. I don't know why they had all these like crap-eating grins on their faces and saying, well, the law has spoken and we have the best system in the world and oh, golly gee, it's not what we wanted, but we're still going to keep smiling and just get on with our lives because it doesn't really concern us that much anyway. That's what I got out of it. When in actuality, they should have been angry. They should have been pissed off. They should never have agreed to that jury in the first place. All white jury, except for one Hispanic. And oh, guess what? George Zimmerman is, what, half white, half Hispanic? Is that what he is? Not that I think race needs to be brought into it, but race really was a part of this the whole time. So you can at least try and be fair. You know, have a token minority of the same ilk of the victim if you want to at least appear fair. Because that's what people were talking about from the very start of this whole thing. That, boy, that jury does not looks a little bit too too homogeneous. Yeah. Not enough variety. And I'm not one to believe that people of one race or ethnicity think alike, but just for perception's sake, and to avoid this kind of conversation that will happen afterwards, you would think that the prosecution would insist on something a little bit more diverse. You'd think that, but they didn't. They had a tough case, and the way the law played out there was just kind of disgusting. It showed how many failings there are. I'll get to that in a second, but let's talk about the defense, their reaction after the verdict was announced. They were literally cracking jokes afterwards. Cracking jokes. I don't even know what the jokes were about. I wasn't really in the mood to hear about jokes. But they were practically high-fiving it right there on TV and expressing indignation that how dare they even bring charges against this guy for killing somebody without anybody witnessing what actually happened and when the guy was unarmed and completely innocent. How dare they? So, yeah, it was pretty disgusting watching both reactions. But the law failed in so many ways because there really wasn't a way to say, we believe this guy was an idiot. He didn't know what he was doing. No, he didn't go in there with the intention of murdering somebody. And I believe that. I believe he wasn't sitting in his car saying, boy, I want to kill me a black guy today. No, I don't think he was saying that or kill anybody. And even when he started chasing him, I don't think murder was on his mind. And yeah, he did make a phone call to the police. And it's pretty clear that there was some racial profiling going on there, and certainly hoodie profiling. But there was no way for the jury to say this guy killed somebody without intention, but boy, he should be held accountable for it. I don't think the manslaughter charge would have been appropriate for that, right? I mean, I'm not a lawyer, and I wasn't paying that close attention to the trial, but it just seemed like all they had to do was present some kind of doubt as to what exactly happened. And boy, you know what? When there's no witnesses, and I mean witnesses to the actual physical altercation, watching blow by blow, like it's worldwide wrestling or something, without that, there can always be a doubt. And that's all they had to do was find a doubt. Yeah, you know what? Maybe he's telling the truth. Maybe he's not. Who knows? Not guilty. Now, can that defense work every time somebody is killed without witnesses? Imagine that. And why did it work this time? And then the other thing which really, really steams me, and that's something that I think we all have to look at, is the reaction of people who aren't part of the case at all, the public. And how sides were taken, and how hypocrisies were revealed. Now, I can find hypocrisies on all the sides. Believe me, I can do that. But let's focus on the side that won, that thinks they won. And what I found was simply incredible. This whole stand your ground thing, this mania that's sweeping at least 20 states, where all you have to do is carry a gun, feel like your life is in danger, and you can kill somebody. Easy as that. And get away with it. And we see how often that kind of power is abused by police. People who are supposed to know better. People who are trained. We see somebody holding a screwdriver 50 feet away, shot dead because, wow, I thought it was a grenade or something. Who knows? And universally supported by the police, by most of the public. Certainly by the government. Those are people who know better. But now, giving that to people who don't know better, people who are not trained, every time there's an altercation, well, I felt my life was in danger, bang, I had to kill him. What do you think's going to happen? This is what's going to happen, more and more times than you can count. But what really floored me was the reaction of the gun lobby. and how telling that was. Okay, you know, I try to understand the arguments. I really do. And I try to predict what they will say. And it seemed to me that in this particular case, what they would say would be, you know, if only Trayvon Martin was armed, this wouldn't have happened. He could have fought off this guy with a gun who was attacking him. And that is what was happening. Trayvon Martin did not attack George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman attacked Trayvon Martin. This is indisputable. There was an altercation afterwards. That's the part that people don't know exactly what happened. But the proof is right there in the 911 transcripts. He calls it in, and he says he is following this guy. He is chasing this guy. It's all right there. When you chase somebody, you're the one provoking the altercation, whatever follows. Right or wrong, you're the one that is provoking. That's what a chase is. So George Zimmerman was the aggressor. He was the one who was attacking. And in all other scenarios that I've been presented with, that is the perfect opportunity to have a gun in the eyes of the gun people. Defend yourself. But you know what? The NRA and the gun lobby and just about everybody that I have seen that that espouses guns and the quote-unquote Second Amendment is not calling for someone like Trayvon Martin to have a gun to defend himself. In fact, when you bring that up, they get indignant. George Zimmerman did the right thing. So you're saying that you don't want black guys to have guns. You don't want kids with hoodies to have guns to defend themselves against people who might attack them. You don't want that. You just want the angry middle-aged white guy to have the gun. Just want to understand the argument here. I thought I understood it. I thought I was finally getting it, you know, that you guys want everyone to arm themselves so that they can protect themselves from all the other people who have armed themselves. It's the stupidest thing in the world, but at least I understood it, and now I don't understand it. Or maybe I do. And so the NRA and all the gun lobbies that I've been able to track so far, if I can find one that thinks differently, I'd love to talk about them. They supported George Zimmerman. They were happy about the verdict. And apparently gun rights in their world only apply to some people and not to all. And, you know, you have to look at other ways this could have played out. And think about it. Think about it carefully and ask yourself, do I really believe this? There was that struggle. The struggle, nobody knows what exactly happened. Well, two people knew at the time. One survived. In that struggle, it could have gone the other way. Trayvon Martin could have grabbed the gun that was being used against him in an unprovoked attack. Again, look at the transcript. That's not me saying that. That's the fact. It was unprovoked. Trayvon Martin did nothing to George Zimmerman except walk by wearing a hoodie and being black, which I guess in some parts of the country is still illegal, but that's all he did. And in that altercation, he could have grabbed the gun and he could have done what George Zimmerman did, fired it to protect himself. Now, do you honestly think, I am asking this question, do you honestly think in that scenario, Trayvon Martin's story would have held up? That he would have been treated the same way as George Zimmerman? I would love to live in a world where that was possible. And if you're one of the people that believes that's possible, share the crack, man, really. Because that is not reality. And you got to be on something to believe that a black kid can shoot somebody in the dark and tell the authorities I was just protecting myself and you just have my word for it and that he'll be believed. That's fantasy. Complete and utter fantasy. So it could have gone that way, or Trayvon Martin could have had a gun of his own. He did not. But what this really proves more than anything else is that a gun in the equation really makes things spiral out of control very, very quickly. Imagine if George Zimmerman did not have a gun. Imagine if he was just walking around or sitting in his car watching everybody going by, because who knows why he was doing that. Maybe he had nothing else to do. Maybe he really cared about the neighborhood and was trying to keep an eye on it. He would have seen somebody that he thought was suspicious based on their appearance. Nothing else. And he would have made that same phone call to the cops. Now, at that point, one of two things could have happened. He would have listened to the cops saying, okay, don't pursue the guy, we're on our way. Or, like the idiot he was, he could pursue this person for no reason at all, chase him, tackle him, fight with him, and get the crap kicked out of him, worst case scenario, or kick the crap out of Trayvon, another worst case scenario. That's as bad as it gets when there's no gun involved. Then you have some court hearings and appointments and things like that where somebody sues somebody else. It would play out completely differently, and you have an 18-year-old kid alive today. But no, you had a gun involved. You had an altercation. You had misunderstandings. You had assumptions. You had death. And how many times do we have to see it play out like this? It's extremely unhealthy, and there are so many victims here. It's just such an incredible tragedy. And yeah, it's a tragedy for George Zimmerman, too. It is. I see that. I can't say he's a racist. I can't say what's in his mind. But I can say, honestly, he probably did not want to do that. And he probably had certain assumptions about people of a different race, as we all do. And he made the mistake of acting on those assumptions with deadly force. Very, very bad idea. But like I said, there's no charge that convicts somebody of being an idiot. I mean, look around us. How could there be? Everybody would be serving time. And an idiot with a gun, idiots with guns, that's on the Florida license plate, for God's sake. You know, they aspire for this kind of thing. Toddlers shooting other toddlers. Guns going off for no reason at all, just because they're lying around on tables, and all kinds of accidents, all kinds of misassumptions, all kinds of stupidity. Idiots abound, and when idiots and guns abound, death shall also abound. It's in the Bible. Read it. And please, if you're in Florida, don't mean to offend. I really don't, because I respect nothing more than people with independent minds who stand up and say what's on their mind, even when the majority disagrees with them. And you don't even have to agree with me. Certainly not about the gun issues. But let's all agree that George Zimmerman was an idiot that night. He did something very stupid. And maybe that's the common ground we can all meet on. So, yeah, I thought I had seen it all. I really did. I thought I'd seen injustice in so many ways, and I guess I saw this coming, but the reaction kind of floored me, and I'm still getting over that. And, oh, boy, you know, you can say that George Zimmerman wasn't acting as a racist. You can say that. You can believe it, too. What you cannot say, though, is that it has not encouraged so many other racists all around to spout their ignorance and their hatred. And if you don't believe me, look at any news story on any website that allows for comments, and you will see these people crawling out from under the woodwork. They're everywhere. And a lot of them are not saying it just to get attention. A lot of them really believe it. That, yeah, Trayvon Martin is just a start. We need to wipe them all out. I won't even repeat some of the things I've seen. But we have a disgusting underbelly in this country still. And not just in this country, in this world. And I think the rest of the planet can take notes from the African-American community here on restraint, on dealing with such injustice with dignity and maturity and patience. And dare I say it, love. I know it sounds corny, but the reaction I've seen over the past few days has been, well, of course, if you watch the mass media, you'll see the few idiots that have broken things. Okay, broken glass. There's always people in the crowds that will do that. You get a bunch of senior citizens together to rally about Social Security, someone's going to smash a plate glass window at some point. Give them time and enough space to do it safely. They'll do it. There's always an idiot in a crowd, sometimes more than one. But for the most part, the demonstrations I've seen have been informative, lively, hopeful, angry. Yes, because you have to be angry at something like this. And it's so funny to see people say, well, he had a fair trial. It's over now. You can't protest against something that played out in the court of law. The system has spoken. The law has spoken. We're a nation of laws. Blah, blah, blah. Just keeps going on and on. And then when you go back in history a little bit to the OJ trial and how that turned out, those same people weren't quite so supportive of the system then. No, the system's been taken over by all the minorities. Can't get a fair trial in this country. You just wind up walking if you're black and you go to prison if you're white. So take all that with a big pillar of salt, because it's meaningless. Fact of the matter is, certain things played out that should not have played out, and justice was not served. There's simply no way you can look at this case and conclude otherwise without blinding yourself to so many things. And this kind of thing happens all over the world, obviously, not just here. Just going through the news before the show, some stories leapt out at me. Italy is one of the most racist countries there is. I'm sorry, I love Italy, I really do, but there are so many racists there, it's not funny. And these racists exist in the echelons of power, not just in the populace. And if you're black in Italy, wow, you've got a lot to get through. It's almost as bad as being Muslim in France. Racism exists everywhere. But this story involves an Italian senator who referred to Italy's first black minister as an orangutan. And he refuses to quit after saying that. Roberto Calderoli represents the Anti-Immigration Northern League. Yeah, they have entire parties for this kind of thing. We do too. But over there, their parties actually have some power because their system works differently. It's a better system. But sometimes evil groups get more power. Sometimes good groups get more power, as opposed to our system, which pretty much stays the same and never changes. So while there's a lot of racism in Italy, there's a lot of chance to change the racism over there in no uncertain terms, if people speak up. But boy, there's a lot of it. Anyway, he represents the Anti-Immigration Northern League. He told Parliament he did a silly thing by referring to this person in that manner and offered to send Cecile Kayenge flowers, because he understands orangutans like flowers. He might as well have said that. He said a majority of parties did not want him to step down, And that sparked a storm of criticism from political leaders and led to calls for his resignation. So in exact opposition to what he said. Basically, the quote was, photographs of the Congolese-born integration minister reminded him of the features of an orangutan. He also said her success encouraged legal migrants and that she should become a minister in her own country. She's an Italian citizen. Quite obviously. But she graciously accepted a phone apology from the senator and invited him to reflect deeply. And again, there's that dignity. There's that maturity in dealing with idiots. Not stooping to their level. And we could sure see a lot more of that. It would do us some good. And then, of course, you have cases of injustice that mirror what's going on down in Florida. In fact, they're happening in Florida. You might have heard about this case. It's been given some attention. But also in Florida, because it was in direct contrast to what happened with George Zimmerman, who actually used his gun to kill an unarmed teenager simply because he suspected him of being up to something. You had a case of a Florida woman who fired warning shots to warn her allegedly abusive husband to stay away from her. She fired warning shots into the wall of her home in August 2010. She told police it was to escape a brutal beating by her husband, against whom she had already taken out a protective order. Oh, and she's African-American, by the way. And for doing that, she received 20 years in prison. Now, I don't know. Is there a relationship? What's the difference here, exactly? Well, she didn't kill the guy. She fired warning shots. And isn't this what the gun people are saying you should use a gun for? To protect yourself. Not seeing them defend her either. 20 years. How about this case? Jordan Davis. Another 17-year-old black kid shot and killed in Florida. This happened in November. 17-year-old Jacksonville resident killed by 46-year-old Michael Dunn, who allegedly shot into the SUV Davis was inside several times after, get this, an argument about the volume of music playing. Now, according to Michael Dunn's own girlfriend, this is her testimony, Dunn had 3 rum and cokes at a wedding reception. She felt secure enough for him to drive because she's a dimwit and thought that he was in a good mood. Well, maybe he was in a good mood after 3 rum and cokes, who knows? But probably not in a good position to drive. Anyway, on the drive back to the hotel that they were staying at, they made a pit stop at a convenience store. And she said that he told her, after pulling up next to these kids in an SUV, that he hated thug music. He hated thug music. He then went inside the store to make some purchases. Or she went inside the store, actually, to make some purchases. And she heard several gunshots while she was still within the building. Upon returning and seeing Dunn put his gun back into the glove compartment, she asked why he had shot at the car playing music, and Dunn claimed that he feared for his life and that they threatened to kill me. Yeah. So he killed one of them. He's being charged with first-degree murder and three counts of attempted murder. So it's kind of the same case. White man shooting a black teenager in a tragic dispute that easily could have been avoided. But for some reason, this case is not receiving the same amount of publicity as the George Zimmerman case. And I'm sure there are many more cases like this throughout the country. And we'll see all kinds of other statements. Several statements today, in fact. Stevie Wonder boycotting Florida and all other Stand Your Ground states. The legendary singer-songwriter said in Quebec City, Canada, to a crowd that he'd boycott Florida on future tours along with any other state that has passed similar Stand Your Ground legislation. I decided today that until the Stand Your Ground law is abolished in Florida, I will never perform there again. As a matter of fact, wherever I find that law exists, I will not perform in that state or in that part of the world. He's, Stevie Wonder, that is, he's known for his music's deeply felt messages of love and community, so it's striking to hear him so angry, according to this LA Times report. His remarks to Sunday's crowd drew a connection between civil rights era activism and the unfinished business of the movement today. He said, "The truth is that for those of you who've lost in the battle for justice, wherever that fits in any part of the world, we can't bring them back. What we can do is we can let our voices be heard, and we can vote in our various countries throughout the world for change and equality for everybody. That's what I know we can do." And if he follows through and boycotts all the Stand Your Ground states, he will have made his touring life significantly more difficult. At least 20 other states have passed similar legislation. Today, Attorney General Eric Holder strongly condemned the so-called Stand Your Ground laws in a speech to the NAACP that addressed the acquittal of George Zimmerman and the killing of Trayvon Martin. "The laws sow dangerous conflict in our neighborhoods," he said, "by allowing and perhaps encouraging violent situations to escalate in public. These laws try to fix something that was never broken. The list of resulting tragedies is long and unfortunately has victimized too many who are innocent." More than 30 states. Is it going up while I'm speaking? I started at 20, 21, now it's 30. More than 30 now, including Florida, have passed Stand Your Ground laws, which allow people to defend themselves with deadly force rather than retreating if they feel they are in danger or in a serious felony is about to be committed. A serious felony is about to commit? So someone's about to commit wire fraud and you can kill them. Yeah, according to this. "The instructions given to the jury said that as long as Zimmerman was not involved in an illegal activity and had a right to be where he was when the shooting occurred, he had no duty to retreat and the right to stand his ground." And again, Trayvon Martin had that exact same right. He just did not have a gun. And I challenge the NRA and all the other groups to say, yeah, he should have had a gun. It's going to confuse your clientele quite a bit, but at least you're saying the same thing. And California officials say they're bracing for more unrest after the Trayvon Martin verdict. Nearly 24 protesters in Los Angeles and Oakland were arrested during a second night of civil disturbance. Police in Los Angeles said the lawlessness was committed by about 150 people who broke off from an otherwise peaceful prayer vigil held in memory of Martin, the unarmed black teenager, shot to death. In the predominantly black Crenshaw district of Los Angeles, vandals set rubbish fires, smashed windows, and assaulted members of a television news crew during several hours of unrest on Monday night. Like I said, there's always idiots in any crowd, and I don't know if there are 150 idiots. That seems like a large amount of idiots. But then again, I don't know how big the crowd was. It's proportional. 14 people were arrested, most of them for failing to heed orders to disperse. It's funny, I got arrested for that. Except they didn't let us disperse. But that's another story. Anyway, anger. Yeah, people are angry. But the vast majority are peaceful in their anger. And you can certainly do that. I also like to read this piece because I just saw this today, and it's pretty stirring. It's a cop's opinion on the verdict. He says, the verdict was ridiculous but not surprising. Anonymous, by the way, so I assume he's a cop. Let's just assume he's a cop. I don't see why somebody would make this up. The verdict was ridiculous but not surprising. The only way I would describe the way that I feel is nausea. I'm just sick that the guy got off and his lawyers are going to shamelessly be doing victory laps on TV for the next several weeks. I also feel so terrible for Trayvon Martin's parents who had to live through that clown show just to see the punk Zimmerman walk. See, he talks like a cop. But right now my burning issue is with all the police officers that defended this idiot from the beginning, because as a cop of 11 years myself, this burns me especially deeply. First off, I'll just say that for me to write this post, I have to be brutally honest about a side of the job that most non-police don't even know that much about. The police-adjacent characters that play a pretty significant role in the career of the average police officer. No, not firemen and EMS. I'm talking about the other people that if you work the street, you get to know by name because you see them that often. They're the medical examiners, the tow truck drivers, and yes, at times, the security types, the bouncers, the security guards. Let's look at the security guards. If you've gone to the calls and done the job, you know dudes like this. You usually meet them pretty early on in your career, and you get used to them. They can be clingy at times. As you gain experience, you learn what they do well and what they don't. Most of the time, the whole precinct knows who they are. They will work security at an apartment complex or a gated community. In my case, I worked a pretty rough side of Atlanta, so there were no gated communities there, only apartments. And trust me, the apartments that had gates were the roughest of all. These security guard types usually know all the neighborhood stuff. They know, or purport to know, who sells the drugs and who is breaking into houses. They definitely know about the noise complaints and the unruly kids. The teens smoking weed. Most of the time, they want you to run some dope boy off or break up the couple having sex in the parking lot. Or maybe they're in over their heads and they find a thug they've talked to a little too sassy and now they've been told they're going to get a beating or worse. And sometimes they do get beat up and worse. There's a place for people like this. They should be respected for what they do, but they should always respect what role they play, and even more than that, the limits of their authority. In my experience, this person gets in over their head a lot. There seems to be this struggle between what they perceive as their authority and what they know is their responsibility. As a cop, they can make your life easier if they just keep the little stuff tamped down, that is, kids running at the pool, loud music complaints. But when you drive up and the security guard hands you a 27-ounce bag of weed that they just confiscated from somebody in a car who's no longer even there because they've run into a now-locked apartment that Mr. Security just happens to have the key to, but he's now begging you to enter with no warrant so that they can help you apprehend the perp. Well, I think you get the picture. Every single play police officer... I'm sorry, the staple got in the way. Every single day, police officers have to make decisions like this. All are trained, some better than others. Security officers choose to make these decisions without the training. Now let's look at the bouncer types. I can't lie, I've worked off-duty at nightclubs and been thankful for the security there. I've been in bar fights so massively bad that they look like a scene from Braveheart. When you're alone and the music is loud and everybody's yelling and screaming and running, it's hard to get backup. So the only thing that has saved my ass a few times was the folks in security until the cavalry got there. Some of these folks are top-notch. Some are ex-pro athletes and martial artists. Some are even models and actors, so you get a healthy mix. Many a night, standing in the cold, waiting for my shift to end. He said, waiting on my shift to end. I've talked to these guys about their dreams, and some I've thought would be some really excellent police officers, and I've told them so. I've encouraged them in the process, calling friends in the department that were recruiters, even given personal references for them. So I definitely appreciate and respect what they do. At times, I've worked with security that were more professional than some of the police officers that I worked the streets with. But then, of course, you've got the real knuckle-draggers that just love to beat people up and then bring them to you looking like a grapefruit, expecting you to look the other way. They're just clowns through and through, and most likely sociopaths. Some of them may be doing drugs on the job. If they're real turds, they may be the ones selling the drugs in the same club they work in. It's a dirty business. But they probably make up only a small part of the population. In both groups, a lot of these guys probably work security because they have a desire at some level to be a police officer. I always took that as a compliment, not with disdain. Law enforcement is an honorable profession and people do good work, but like any other job, you have to have good people to do the good work. I've always believed that it is the combination of intelligence, integrity, and courage that makes an average police officer a good officer, but I believe it is empathy that comes with experience that makes a good officer great. It is the same dynamic for security officers. The vast majority of these people are hardworking folks that are very good at what they do. They are a true asset to law enforcement as long as they stay in their lane and do what they're supposed to do. I'm no longer a police officer. I'm actually a counselor now. We have this term in the mental health field that we use that's called scope of practice. If you're a mental health counselor, practicing outside of your scope will get your ass in trouble and your license revoked. Practicing outside your scope of practice in law enforcement will get your certification revoked and your ass prosecuted and put in prison. But what happens if you're a security guard and you work outside of your scope of practice? Well, it looks like you can shoot somebody and walk free. There's more to it, but that's the gist of it. And it gives some perspective as to how law enforcement ties into all of this. And the I guess the surprise that a lot of people felt to see so many in law enforcement supporting what George Zimmerman did when it was clearly the wrong thing to do, when it was clearly something that was done out of ignorance, done out of inexperience, done out of panic. And that's at best. That's not even introducing the malice aspect into all of this. That's assuming he had the best intentions. So I guess I've talked through the whole show about this one issue. I had other things to talk about, but boy, hours go by quickly, don't they? I guess the thing to keep in mind is that we need to consider every situation with maturity and caution and think things through, because you never know what's on the other side of any kind of conversation, be it a good conversation or an altercation of any sort. Well, that's going to do it for us here tonight. OTW@2600.com. That's our email address. Have a good night.
The old man turned off the radio, said, "Where did all of the old songs go? Kids sure play funny music these days, and they play it in the strangest way. Said, it looks to me like they've all gone wild. It was peaceful back when I was a child. Well, man, could it be that the girls and boys are trying to be heard above your noise? And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?" A little boy of three sitting on the floor looks up and says, "Daddy, what is war?" "Son, that's when people fight and die." A little boy of three says, "Daddy, why?" Young man of 17 in Sunday school, being taught the golden rule. And by the time another year's gone around, it may be his turn to lay his life down. Can you blame the voice of youth for asking, what is true? Young man sitting on the witness stand, the man with the book says, "Raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear." The man looked down at his long hair, and although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is true? The young girl dancing to the latest beat has found new ways to move her feet. The young man speaking in the city square is trying to tell somebody that he cares. Yeah, the ones that you're calling wild are gonna be the leaders in a little while. This old world's waking to a newborn day, and I solemnly swear that it'll be their way. You better help that voice of youth find what is truth. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Hey kids, Finn with you, Finn's Revolution, until the 9 p.m. hour right here on WUSB Stony Brook. We are very, very lucky tonight to have the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Alan Ankles of the Stony Brook Film Festival with us. Stay tuned. It starts this week. You could be lucky. In the background here, the Rolling Stones doing Brown Sugar, and we're playing such comparative classic rock right here on Finn's Revolution for a reason, because A, it's a great song, and B, of course, it is going to be in the
film, featured in the film Muscle Shoals, which is showing at the Stony Brook Film Festival this week. And we're discussing that because Mr. Alan Inkles is right here with us. Alan Inkles is the director of the Stony Brook Film Festival, among many other things. And Alan, how are you?
And I'm great. I know it's Stony Brook Film Festival time because I'm on your show. That's the official kickoff.
That's right. And when does it start this year?
We open up on Thursday night, two nights from now. Yeah, we have it's amazing that from January 1, looking at films, or even earlier, because films come in earlier than that, that we are here, 2 days away from opening night. Pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And it seems like, it's got to be age, I guess, on my part, but it seems like it comes faster and faster every year with more and more great films.
It is pretty amazing. You know, we have the Arts Center year-round. You know, we have 300 shows we present and produce from September through May. And somehow, some way, this amazing team of mine get together, you know, 4 or 5 months early, and we put together this phenomenal, you know, 10-day festival of these great, great films.
Yeah, so it runs from Thursday the 18th, which is opening night, right through Saturday the 27th. So it's 10 full days of an amazingly packed schedule of great, great films. And Alan, how many has it been at this point?
This is the 18th year. Phenomenally. I can't believe it's 18 years. And each year we get more and more films. You know, we've gotten more and more well known. We've got a lot of filmmakers that talk up the great deal of coming out to Stony Brook and being on this great campus and hanging out with all of us and big crowds and this big 1,000-seat theater. So between word of mouth and, you know, just us getting more and more connected to more distributors and sales agents, both, you know, in the U.S. and abroad, we get more and more interest. We had almost 850 films that came through my doors. You know, about two-thirds of those were entries that came in out of the blue from ads or from word of mouth or from talking to the filmmakers and returning filmmakers. And a couple hundred were films that sort of I go after. You know, I follow a lot of filmmakers. I follow a lot of actors who've been through our doors. I've got a lot of sales agents I work with and distributors. So between what I'm soliciting and what's coming in on its own, it's more than doubled in the last 5 years. I remember the numbers were 400 or 500, and they're now, you know, and that wasn't more than 3 or 4 years ago. And now with digital age, that everything's digital, and, you know, a film can be made a lot less expensively and a lot easier. You know, a good film still takes a lot more work and a lot of effort, but at least, you know, what you've got to wade through is a lot more now. And I'm not saying that there's 800 great films that come through, but there's a good 100 or so that are really viable, and you've got to find the 30 or 40 of those that really end up on our schedule.
Now, let me ask you, before we start to discuss the schedule, as we always do every year, when you get those 850 or so submissions, are there cases, and, you know, you can be honest with us, it's a small audience, it's only a few thousand people.
I'd always tell you the truth.
Do you already have some word on some films that, not only that you've researched, but positively, but do you ever get any kind of, like, negative vibe on a film that you say, I don't know about this? I don't know if this will work for my audience.
Sort of before, before I've seen it, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, look, you know, it's interesting. You know, John Anderson, who's the New York film critic who writes for Variety and New York Times,
right,
and LA Times, he always sort of jokes, but probably half jokes, that I book my festival for my audience, you know. And I always say, and what's wrong with that? You know, but the reality is, you know, you've got a real – look, I've got probably 5 or 6 films in this festival that are a stretch for audience. We've got some very mood kind of films. I'd call them sort of pseudo-experimental, but not really to the sort of – hardcore film festival crowd that goes and sees films all over. You know, we're Long Island, we're Stony Brook, we've got a 1,000-seat theater. We've got to realize that most of our audience wants a good story, great directing, great acting, sort of narrative beginning, middle, and end, or a documentary that's fairly worldly. And I think we try to do that with a lot of the films. But I want to challenge our audience too. So yeah, there are films that come in. I mean, there's one or two films that came in that I read about that I thought would be a little bit of a stretch for audience. I'll give you a good example, the film The Wait, which I think is probably the wheelhouse for our audience today. It's a Jenna Malone, Chloe Savini indie film, M. Blash, who did Lying. It's got a Melancholia kind of feel to it, the film Melancholia. It's slow. It's sort of moody. It's sort of picturesque. And yet it sort of moves at a kind of snail's pace, but it's really good acting and good directing. It's probably not a typical film that my audience is going to wrap their arms around and see some great, you know, great Dutch stars. Or you know, we love the Dutch, my audience. But it's one of these films that I felt we had to have, a film called Soft Gun. I mean, we'll get to the films, but it was made for $10,000 Canadian. And it's this road movie of these, you know, young people, these college, six, seven college kids got together up in Canada and made this movie. And it's what I get about 200 of, and 199 of them just weren't good enough, and one was really good. So, yeah, there are some that come in and I sort of have a predisposition one way or another too, but I really try and give these films a really fair chance. I mean, if I open up the film and put it on the screen, I don't charge an entry fee. We've discussed this before.
Right.
I don't believe in it. I'm not going to take the last $50 the filmmakers got after, you know, borrowing money from mom and dad and maxing out their credit cards and say, give me money for me to show you a film, which is sort of the norm in this business.
Right.
So when I get a film in, I give it a fair chance. But if 10 minutes in, it is just pitiful. I didn't charge them anything, and I'll pop it out and put the next DVD in. So, but I do try and give everything a really fair shake, and I've got a team of people, but ultimately the buck stops here, and I'm going to look at anything that's going to be on our screen I've looked at.
Okay.
Did I answer the question? Probably did.
Yes, somewhere. You did. You did.
What was the question?
Okay. Okay, so this Thursday, let's just start at the beginning of the fest. The opening night. First of all, the opening night is a special thing for many reasons. A, it's the first film of the series, but also you have an opening night reception. And it's a very, very nice thing. And I don't know if there's any more reception tickets available.
The nice thing is for the audience, maybe not as much for me, is we're not sold out yet. I mean, it's we got a 1,000-seat theater. It's July. It's Long Island. There's a lot to do here. We've sold 700 passes, which is amazing. We've sold a couple hundred tickets for each movie, but each movie still has a good 100-150 tickets left for, except the Flight 800. We can get to that when we get onto that date. Mm-hmm, we'll talk about that interesting film.
Yep.
So there are tickets, and people should, I certainly encourage folks to go out and go online and pick up tickets for the movies.
And of course, they can go to StonyBrookFilmFestival.com, StonyBrookFilmFestival.com.
We got passes for $80, passes, which is a
tickets,
steal. Take whatever you want. We got parties, we got passes, we got movie tickets. If there's something, and a lot of the films on the website, most of them have trailers, so you can take a look and see if it's your cup of tea.
And it's a great site. It's a very well-organized site, and you can just, as Alan just said, you can just hit that film and see that trailer as well. And a very nice thing, of course, is the very special opening night events. And tell us what's happening on opening night.
Yeah, you know, it's, again, as I said, Zaytoun, an Israeli film. Eran Rickles is a wonderful Israeli filmmaker. We've had two of his films before. We've had Three Mothers that he produced.